All right. As we talked about last week, this 24th chapter of Matthew may be a little bit easier to understand or clearer, at least, when we put it right after chapter 23, which is logically where it comes, of course. But in chapter 23 had these woes pronounced. It sounds very much like there's judgment coming. There's something bad afoot. There's danger near. And Jesus finished off that 23rd chapter, mourning over Jerusalem in verse 37. In verse 38, making a kind of compelling statement, ominous statement in verse 38, "See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" And then verse 1 of chapter 24, "Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple." We did just finish studying from Ezekiel on Wednesday nights. And this kind of, I don't know if Matthew is intentionally trying to invoke this kind of idea. Maybe not, but it is something that I think of, at least. We talked several weeks back about Jesus cleansing the temple and how that might actually be looked at as not cleansing the temple so much as cursing it, pronouncing judgment upon not the temple itself and what it was meant to be, but what it had come to represent and what it was being used for and the people who were using it in that way. In much the same way, curses the fig tree. Then kind of in larger form, there is the pronouncement upon the temple. It had become a den of thieves. It was a den of robbers. And its time is coming to a close. And now you have Jesus saying, verse 38, I think that's the reference, your house is left to you desolate. It's going to be emptied. It's going to be made desolate. And then Jesus went out and departed from the temple in verse 1. Again, it feels like a similar process or a similar setup to what you found in Ezekiel, maybe in those early chapters, especially chapter 8 through 11, where you have the glory of God, this great presence of God that Ezekiel had seen, this, you know, majestic thing, very difficult to describe or maybe even to look at. But what does Ezekiel see as God is showing him the vision of what's going to happen? The glory of God leaves. It kind of rises up from Jerusalem, from the temple, and it goes. It's gone. And it's not until later, when he's depicting the restoration, that we'll see the glory of God returning. And it's going to have, there's going to be this new temple that it's going to inhabit and all of those things. But here is Jesus saying to the scribes and the Pharisees, saying to the Jews at that time, your house has left you desolate. And while he has been filling the temple with his glory during these last few days, teaching and healing and doing the things of God in that place where they had not been done for a long time, in truth, now he leaves. He rises up to depart the temple. And again, maybe there is some symbolism there, but it's at least what comes to mind when we're looking at it, especially there in verse 39. I think that's what Jesus is getting at when he says, you'll see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. It is a similar idea, at least, to what Rob looked at numerous times throughout our Ezekiel study. What was kind of the main point, the recurring theme throughout that book? You will know, or they will know, that I am the Lord. They will know that a prophet has been among them. They will understand who and what this truly was. And that seems to be at the root of what Jesus is saying there. The next time you see me, the next time you perceive that I am here, that it is my coming, you'll understand the truth of everything I've been saying up to this point. You'll understand who I truly was and what I was trying to indicate to you. At any rate, they leave the temple, and again, there at the end of verse 1, I don't know in what way we're meant to take that. His disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. Some surmise that they were kind of pointing out how cool it was, you know, and how wonderful it was, and all of the various features of the temple. Could have been that maybe they were trying to do that. If you read descriptions of the temple at this time that I guess was kind of finished by this point, Herod the Great had started renovations or kind of updating of the temple that had went on for at least 46 years, nearly 50 years. And if you read about how much money was put into that and how many, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of workers and priests that were overseeing everything and gold overlaying all these various parts and huge columns and the stones. Some of you have been to the area as it stands today. There's not a temple there, of course, but you can see some of the things that were there, some of the groundwork at least. Big, giant stones, you know, 10 cubits long. That would be a stone that was used to build this place. It was an impressive structure. I'm told, Josephus says at least, which especially on this topic, I don't know that he would be entirely trustworthy, but he says that when Titus did come in and destroy the city in the year 70 AD, he didn't want to destroy the temple. He said, keep it. It's beautiful. It's not something that we'd want to wreck. And that one of his men started a fire against his orders. And so all of that happened kind of contrary to what the Romans actually even wanted because it was so beautiful. So maybe here in Matthew 24, 1, you know, when his disciples come and show him the buildings of the temple, maybe that's what is in mind. You know, this is our first trip to Jerusalem in a while, maybe for some of them. Look at how impressive all of this is. Maybe they perceive some of the things that he has already been saying and are asking or pointing out with a bit of questioning. Are you talking about this? Are you talking about all of this beautiful structure? Is God going to destroy this great sign of the privilege of his people to call upon his name and to know his glory, those sorts of things? But Jesus says, yeah, go ahead, take a look. Go ahead and look at all these things. But realize that not one stone shall be left here upon another that will not be thrown down. Seems also to be a reference to scripture that had talked about the temple being built, one stone upon another. And now Jesus says that there's not going to be one stone put on another. Speaking metaphorically, just to say, of course, it's going to be destroyed. It's going to be brought down. Now, the question his disciples ask, or we should say questions, in verse 3. Jesus withdraws a little way away, out of the city proper. He goes to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples come privately. Again, I don't know how many this would be, if it's referring there to simply the apostles or even a smaller group within them. Matthew doesn't say, but a smaller group comes to him and says, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Now, I do think that second sentence, the very end of verse 3, it does seem to be asking one question. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age, or at least your coming and the end of the age, they do seem to be lumping into one question, one idea. There's only one article there found in the Greek, and it just seems they're understanding those things to be synonymous. Your coming is the end of the age. But it is interesting, at least, that in their question, they are also maybe showing some understanding of what Jesus has said, and at least the nature of what that visitation would be like. It's after he has talked about, or after Matthew has reported him talking about that temple being destroyed, not one stone being left upon another, and they want to know what's the sign of your coming. They equate that to when you come, that will happen. And Jesus, of course, is going to portray it in those terms throughout the rest of chapter 24. But they do have two pretty clearly defined questions, and Jesus will look at them in reverse order. First, what is the sign? And then secondly, when? When is it actually going to happen? Gary? Okay. We touched on this a little bit last week. I know we're just kind of developing that further, but I do agree with Brother Guerin to large extent. I think probably each one of us had come down on this in some slight variation of the same idea. Those of us who agree in general, at least, you'd say, well, but maybe the different part starts here, or maybe it starts in this verse, or whatever. But I do think that in this whole teaching, which is going to go until the end of chapter 25, there is Jesus looking at a judgment on Jerusalem, and eventually, at some point, also expanding that to talk to his disciples about really more of a general need for preparation for any kind of judgment. No matter what happens, no matter what kind of judgment we're talking about, if that means that you live in the city of Jerusalem in the year 70 AD and you are there when it all starts going very badly and you're there when the enemy comes and encircles the city, etc., that is a judgment of God upon something. That's a judgment of God upon Jerusalem, upon the temple, etc., as we've talked about. But if you don't live during that time, or if you survive that time, or whatever it might be, there is still going to be a judgment for you, isn't there? There's still going to be, like verse 46 of Matthew 24 is going to say, "Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing, being a wise and faithful servant." Isn't that going to be appropriate at any time, under any circumstance, that when the Lord comes for any reason, in some kind of judgment, or simply to end everything, there's the need for preparation. And that's what these parables that Jesus then begins to tell will look at, maybe moving towards more and more finality of judgment, to the point where, like when you start in verse 31, the parable of, or the kind of the story of sheep and goats being separated left and right, we can see a clear parallel there if you're looking at, yeah, the end of time, men being judged for their deeds. What's the basis that God's going to look at when he is seeing those who know him and those who do not? That sounds more like final judgment. So I do think that there is both in mind. We'll go ahead and mention that from the beginning. I would say, though, that when Jesus is talking about his coming, that can also be, and maybe primarily should be, understood as what's going to happen to Jerusalem, what's going to happen to the temple. And that idea of God visiting, or God coming, or God's appearing is used throughout the prophets, and I think is also used here to talk not about the second coming when the clouds open and all those sorts of things, but God visiting the world in judgment and in punishment, usually. Wilson?
Every time I've studied this, it goes back in my mind what Paul told the young man Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:15. Mm-hmm. The King James Version said, "Study to show thyself approved." The New King James said, "Be diligent to show thyself approved." And in the last part of it, it says, "Rightly dividing the word of truth." Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 It does warrant a careful look, and maybe two or three careful looks. Yeah. Good to remember. All right. Well, so here are the questions. When's that going to happen? Jesus has just said, take a good last look at the temple, sort of, because it's not always going to be here. And they say, when and how are we going to know ahead of time? Which is a pretty fair question too. So beginning in verses 4 through 14 is sort of a setup to answering that second question. What will be the sign of your coming in the end of the age? Jesus lists several things that are noticeable events, noticeable things. Verses 4 and 5, maybe people trying to deceive you, false Christs who would come and say, I'm the Messiah, and deceive many people that way. Verse 6, war and rumors of wars, right? Political disturbances, fighting, things like that going on. Nation rising against nation, kingdom against kingdom in verse 7. Also verse 7, kind of some natural disruption, famines, pestilence, earthquakes in various places. Verse 9, my disciples, Jesus is talking to, you're going to have trouble specifically that maybe is unique because you are my disciples. They'll deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. You'll be hated by everyone for my name's sake. Verse 10, it won't just come maybe from the government or from people who are obviously opposed to me, but you might be betrayed. You might be handed over by someone who knows you. Verse 12, lawlessness will abound. The love of many will grow cold. So you're going to have a lot of immorality. You're going to have people who maybe began in the way and they were shipwrecked. Their faith was shipwrecked, as Paul would use that language. Many will fall away. And verse 14, the gospel of the kingdom is going to be spread. It's going to be preached everywhere. All the nations will hear this gospel. All right. Those are in general terms what Jesus is setting up there. How well do those signs function as signs? If you understand what I'm asking there. Do those seem kind of vague, I guess, is maybe a better question. If we're trying to identify a specific period in time, I'm warning you about some big event that's going to happen. I'm not going to tell you when yet, but I'll just say before it happens, there's going to be a lot of war in the world, and there will be some natural disasters, and there will be a lot of immorality in the world. People will hate each other, and people will maybe not like Christians especially. And when all of that stuff happens, then you're going to know when this thing that I'm warning you about happens. You might say, that doesn't really help a lot to pinpoint a day. That doesn't really help a lot if I'm trying to say May 1st, 2022, because we had all of that happening leading up to it. In large part, some of those things happen all the time. There's always been war. There's always been rumors of wars. There's always been earthquakes. There's always been famines. There's always been pestilence. There's always been men who hate each other. There's always been lawlessness. There's always been people who rise up and say, I come from God. I'm a prophet of God. I'm the Messiah. I'm the Christ, whatever it is, and try to deceive people in that way. A lot of what Jesus is talking about leading up to verse 14 is general. And I'm not leveling that as a criticism, saying he didn't do a good job answering the question. I think Jesus, he's not being deliberately vague, but he's just setting the scene to say these are not signs themselves necessarily, but they are the things that will happen. This is part of the program leading up to what the sign of my coming is going to be. This is setting the stage for all of that. Linda?
Well, verse 7, when he says, in
various places. Yes. Yeah, there in verse 8, kind of partially is a way of saying, yeah, and it's also going to get worse, but also to say this is just part of it. This is just simply a part of everything that is going to happen. So okay, there's maybe some preparation for the big event, but not signs themselves necessarily. And for that, in verse 15, Jesus then really starts answering the question. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Okay, this is actually how you can identify what he is warning them about. What is the abomination of desolation? Matthew mentions, he adds, either himself or Jesus giving that aside, that it's spoken of by Daniel the prophet. What is the abomination of desolation? Greg?
Mentioned by Daniel, it's coincides with the end of sacrifices in the temple and setting up something that was going to be an abomination.
Okay. It largely has that specific point to it. When that happened in Daniel, there's going to be that end of sacrifices. And it's something that Daniel was himself looking forward to, maybe in an immediate sense, was going to be a horrible thing for the Jews, a horrible event that took place. Some, for those people, for that generation that lived, a life-altering thing that would feel kind of like the end of the world in many ways. Anyone know specific referent or anything further on that? Rob? Okay, so Rob is pointing out there Antiochus Epiphanes, a Seleucid king, a Syrian king, who is going to do exactly what that sounds like, an abomination of desolation. That's heavy. Those are a couple of heavy words to put right next to each other, and it's very heavy things that are going to happen when he takes control of Judea. The sacrifices are going to stop. He, in fact, himself is going to profane the temple with some sacrifices of his own, erect an image of himself in the temple, do a lot of things described in various ways. The book of Maccabees that Rob mentioned, I think, it's during that Maccabean period. But if you read the history found in the book of the Maccabees, you see a lot of the awful things perpetrated against the Jews. They were not allowed to have a copy of the scriptures. They were not allowed to circumcise their children, all those sorts of things. And on pain of death, they were slaughtered mercilessly if they did that. It's a horrible thing that Daniel was looking forward to, meaning seeing it, foreseeing it. And that had happened in their history. That would have been a couple hundred years before this, when Jesus is talking. Yeah, Linda. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of finality there, isn't there? A lot of finality that we're going to see in these next few days that we're going to see in the rest of our study. And that is kind of the end, and the body keeps living for another 40 years or so, almost, is what you see happening. Gary, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, very, very final, it's a desecration that takes place. in both times, when what Daniel was referring to and now what Jesus is referring to, using that imagery, using that same language, kind of using that as a metaphor almost. So Jesus is similar to what he had done on previous occasions. We talked last week about several times where Jesus has pointed out to his listeners, especially to his enemies maybe, the same thing that's happening now is just what has happened previously. Like back in chapter 23, verse 35, where he's saying, your forefathers killed and crucified prophets, and you say you'd never do that, and you're just doing it again. It's just history repeating itself when you kill me and when you crucify me and persecute all of my apostles and disciples. It's just the same thing. Jerusalem is just doing the same thing that it always has. And now here again, it's Jesus saying history will repeat itself, just with much more finality this time. But that is the sign that Jesus gives. And Matthew's version maybe is not as clear about what exactly that sign is referenced to. There's reference to an encircling army. The besieging armies is really what Jesus is getting at. It's found a little bit here, but also I think Mark and Luke will maybe describe it in a little bit clearer terms, that Jesus is saying, kind of summarizing version, when you see Rome come and begin to encircle the city and look like they might attack and look like they might really be angry about something that you've done, it's real, and they're serious that time when it happens. Because, again, the tendency for the Jews for so long, for hundreds of years by this point, had been to say, well, nothing's really going to happen to us. We're God's people. We have the temple. There's safety in that, and nothing is going to happen to us. And Jesus is going to tell them again here, when Rome comes against you this time, they mean it. And you'll want to be gone. You will want to not be there at that time. And that's what he spends a lot of the rest of that section looking for, or telling them to be on the lookout for. Don't go back to pack up. If you see that first horseman riding over the ridge, don't go back to gather your clothes and get the family photo album and all those sorts of things. Get out of town. Leave. It's time to go, because it's all going to be destroyed. So that is given to us in varying language. By verse 29 is where we start seeing things that sound more cosmic and sound more to most people reading it like the end of the world. The sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, the powers of the heavens will be shaken, all these sorts of things. But this is just apocalyptic language. It's metaphorical language. It's prophetic language that's found all throughout the Old Testament to describe God's judgment. God is visiting the earth in judgment, and it will feel like the end of the world for those people, but it's not the literal end of all things. It's God coming in judgment against Jerusalem, and that's what Jesus is trying to prepare them for. David? Yes. Yes. Yeah, verse 25. See, I've told you beforehand. Verse 16, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. There's the possibility of escape, both beforehand and kind of during or after, I guess, like verse 22. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened, seemingly saying on behalf of those Christians who would remain there in Jerusalem, it's not, the whole city isn't just going to be removed from the map. it won't even be as bad maybe as it could have been for their sake. So there is a, that is a key difference, I guess, that you would find as things move more and more to end of world judgment. This would not be the case for everyone. But the need for that preparation for God's judgment becomes universal when we understand, as he goes further on, that all will stand before God in some judgment or another eventually. Kenny? Yeah. Yeah. And I think, look at verse 23, for instance. Matthew 24, beginning there in verse 23. If anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there, do not believe it. And I may be mistaken on this, but this seems, beginning verse 23, going down about verse 26, maybe Jesus is looking at some of that confidence or some of that almost self-deception that people like to have in those matters, that maybe Rome is here, the army has encircled us, the abomination of desolation is here, but Christ is going to come and save us. God is still going to send his Messiah, you know, kind of swooping in at the last minute and drive off Rome like we always knew he would, like we always knew God was going to look out for us and give us our kingdom back and get rid of the emperor and do all those things. So here's the Christ. Look, he's coming. He is coming to rescue us. Salvation has come at long last. And so it's not going to be that bad. Everybody calm down. Everybody just keep a cool head. God is going to deliver out of this. And he says, don't believe it. Those are false Christs. Those are false prophets, and they're going to try to deceive you with those things. The real Christ is behind this judgment. It is him who is decreeing that these things would be so because of the wickedness that these people have heaped up before God. He's not going to deliver them out of it. He's not going to save them from it. It's his judgment against them that is causing all of that. So, yeah, don't take any false security in anything when all of this starts. David?
And you can also back up to verse 20, because there is going to be limitations to his escape.
Yeah.
If it's in winter, I mean, it's going to be a hardship for his escape. If it's on the Sabbath, the gates are going to be closed.
Yeah. Yeah, and right, and he'll mention several things about, you know, classes of people that are going to have an especially difficult time during this period because they can't flee as quickly. It's going to be slower for them. So it's a picture of doom. It's a pretty heavy set of statements that Jesus is making, a heavy topic that he is looking at here, that it's all going to be ending, the finality of this whole system. The temple is going to be gone. The sacrifices are going to cease. Their way of life is going to change irrevocably. And so all of that is kind of answering that idea of the sign of your coming. He's essentially telling them what his coming is in the first place, that it is It is this visitation and judgment against the temple, against Jerusalem. But the timing of that, the question of, well, when? Can you prepare us ahead of time and tell us, you know, what year that might be, what day that might be? That isn't going to be as clear. And he says, no, I really can't. I'm not going to tell you. Verse 36, if this is still looking at that judgment, of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. The point behind all of this, and it grows increasingly clear when you get to the parables in chapter 25, the point is that in large part, preparation for judgment does not depend on when the judgment is. It's not a matter of knowing, I've got a test on Tuesday, so I'm going to study on Sunday and Monday, and you know, then I know the exact time. That's the only way I can be prepared, is if I know that that test is on Tuesday. My terrible habit when I was in college was trying to figure out how much time do I need to study and when is the test, and then kind of work backwards from then, right? I've got an 8 o'clock test in this class, and I should study for about 4 hours, so I'll wake up at 4 in the morning and just do all the studying that I need to then, and then so then I'll be ready for it, right? Really dumb way of approaching things. But it's kind of the same problem here. The need for preparation to begin as soon as possible, the need for preparation at all times becomes the important concern. And so that's the wise and foolish versions. Which one is wise? The one who's ready, the one who's prepared. The parable of the talents. Which servant has done well? Which servant has done the will of his master? Well, the one who has taken what he can, has worked and has labored and has been smart and wise in the time that he was given. And the time of the master's return isn't an important part of the parable, really, because he's coming back. They know he's coming back. The when is not really the issue in that parable. And beginning in verse 31, this judgment, goats and sheep, and those who had treated their brethren well and those who had not. Is time a consideration in that one whatsoever? Well, no, not really. He's going to judge. He's going to do that. The important part for you is simply right now to do what you know is right to do. And so that just really is the focus of all of this eventually. You have a decision to make right now. Verse 42, watch therefore, for you don't know what hour your Lord is coming. If we could all try to cram right before and said, well, God's coming tomorrow at noon, so it's almost like getting kids to behave around Christmas time, right? Be good because Santa's looking and you want to end up on the nice list. So, well, okay, I'll be good. And then December 26th, I'll start being a little terror again because Santa doesn't take into account the earlier stuff. It's the same foolish principle, the same foolish idea that we can just say, well, if I know when, then I can start preparing right beforehand. And Jesus is saying, you prepare now. You watch and be ready. That is how you will show your wisdom, because he's coming at an hour you do not expect. Gary, go ahead. That seems to be the important point he's getting at. Julie, and then Ron.
If we wait till the end, consider all the blessings and the greatness of God that we miss.
Yeah, good point. There's foolishness in simply forsaking all of that right now. It's not just trying to get into heaven at the end or some kind of idea like that. Ron, go ahead, and then I think I'm out of time.
Some of the signs and wonders that he's been talking about here were fulfilled at his
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Some of the very things that he mentions there would happen very, very shortly, in fact. All right. Thank you very much for your time. I know there's a lot to get to in that chapter, really in all of those chapters. We're not going to be able to cover it well in one setting. So apologies for the brevity and kind of the skipping around, but hopefully that clarifies a few things and sets us up for what's going to happen. Jesus, throughout all that discourse, has been talking about judgment. He has been talking about why what is about to happen is going to happen. And we'll see the Jews doing exactly what he was saying they were going to do as chapter 26 begins. They're going to plot to kill him, just as he has predicted. And the punishment for that will be just as predicted as well. All right, we'll continue with that next week. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.